There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman, I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is on vacation. And today, we're going to see the intersection of intellectual property and voting rights. Jeff Nicholson-Owens, host of WEF's own Digital Citizen, is here to help explain how all these things are connected and why we all should be interested about what's going on behind the voting booth. And also, we'll catch up with the news of our media environment, and especially catch up on the recent ruling against the FCC. Stay tuned. So unfortunately, due to transmitter trouble, Media Geek was not on last Friday, and I was not able to bring you this news fresh, but we have the additional few days of thought and analysis time to expand upon it. But as you might have heard, last week on June 24th, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the FCC's new loosened media rules, sending them back to the FCC to be reviewed and rewritten. This ruling is not a rejection of loosening media rules per se, but a rejection of the reasoning that Michael Powell's FCC used to justify its decisions, which the court described as based on, quote, irrational assumptions and inconsistencies, end quote. The most significant rule that was stopped by the court is the FCC's loosening of the cross-ownership ban, which would have allowed TV stations, newspapers, and radio stations to be commonly owned in a single market. It was this change that media activists feared would single-handedly trigger the greatest increase in media consolidation while greatly decreasing media diversity, especially on the local level. While the court agreed with the FCC that the ban on newspaper TV cross-ownership should be repealed, the court rejected the rules that would limit such cross-ownership. The court specifically attacked an FCC method, a method the FCC calls the Diversity Index, which the commission planned to use to measure the relative diversity of a given media market, so as to determine how many different kinds of media outlet a single company would be permitted to own. The court criticized how the FCC planned to weight various types of local media outlets, writing that, quote, a diversity index that requires us to accept that a community college television station makes a greater contribution to viewpoint diversity than a conglomerate that includes the third largest newspaper in America, also requires us to abandon both logic and reality, end quote. But most importantly, the court rejected the FCC's contention that it could count locally based internet websites in the diversity index. In its decision, the court wrote, quote, there is a critical distinction between websites that are independent sources of local news and websites of local newspapers and broadcast stations that merely republish the information already being reported by the newspaper or broadcast station's counterpart. The latter do not represent an independent viewpoint and thus should not be considered as contributing diversity to local markets, end quote. Finally, the court strongly chastised the FCC for not releasing the details of the diversity index to the public for comment prior to being adopted. In fact, it was Chairman Michael Powell's very refusal to engage public comment on the entire media rules review process that ignited grassroots opposition and interest in the media ownership issue. The Third Circuit Court's review of the FCC's media ownership rules rewrite was brought on by lawsuits filed by the low-power radio advocacy group, the Prometheus Radio Project, and by the National Association of Broadcasters. Much of the court's reasoning in this case was adopted from the arguments put forth by Prometheus and the Media Access Project, which acted as its legal counsel. The court rejected nearly all of the arguments from the NAB, which was challenging the rules because this group believes the FCC did not go far enough in its loosening of ownership restrictions. Without a doubt, Chairman Powell was the driving force behind the FCC's decision to loosen media ownership rules, a move that was expected given the chairman's constant expression of his supposed free market ideology. And as chairman, Powell certainly was the most influential figure in guiding and framing the research the FCC conducted as part of the rules review process. This body of research was first released in October 2002, before most of the public, including grassroots activists, had even heard of the ownership rules review. Even then, it was clear that the research was biased to favor a loosening of ownership rules by relying on shallow metrics that only counted the number of media outlets rather than evaluating the actual diversity of content available on them. You can read my initial critique of this research at the Media Geek website, www.mediageek.org. In the aftermath of the court's rebuke of the FCC's new rules, this week the Los Angeles Times published a story speculating that Powell will step down from the FCC before the year is out. Although the commission officially denies that Powell has any intention to leave, prominent media and telecommunications lobbyists have been stepping up their efforts to push their agendas, since Powell is viewed as one of the most industry-friendly FCC chairs in recent history, and any change in leadership at the commission will likely reduce lobbyist influence. In the event that John Kerry wins the presidential election in November, he will replace Powell with a Democratic appointee. But if Bush wins, Powell might step down, especially since he has lost favor with many prominent congressional Republicans who were critical of the chairman's refusal to give much consideration to public opinion, his lack of political grace, and his ham-fisted approach towards regulatory issues that have brought him into the conflict with another FCC Republican, Commissioner Kevin Martin. The leadership of the FCC will continue to be important for media ownership issues since the FCC has been ordered to review these rules again, and the door has been left open for Powell to effect more loosening, provided he can justify the changes to the court's satisfaction. And that's a bit of what's happened in our media environment. We can see that elections and voting have great effects, not just in who is president, but in the media, which helps in the electing and unelecting of these people. This is Media Geek. In just a moment, I'll be talking to Jeff Nicholson Owens about electronic voting and how that relates to issues of intellectual property, free software, and what it all means to us. You definitely want to stay tuned. Welcome back to Media Geek. My name is Paul Reeson. I'm your host, and with me in the studio today is Jeff Nicholson Owens, host of WEF's own Digital Citizen, alternating Wednesdays at 8 p.m. When is your next program on, Jeff?
It'll be on, well, there will be a Digital Citizen on in 2 weeks. I just had a show this past Wednesday.
Okay.
But I'm on vacation starting, well, tonight, actually. And so in a month, in 2 weeks after, you'll be able to hear me.
Okay, so. And on this program you review intellectual property, our rights as citizens in a digital age.
Yeah, and I talk a lot about free software, and I approach the question of how people ought to treat each other when they're talking about issues relating to the computer, which is a field that a lot of people think about in dry terms, like it's all about the mechanics of doing stuff on the computer, and it has nothing to do with ethics or your freedom to express yourself freely. And it's a rather novel, if I dare say so myself, take on the whole thing. But I have to admit, I copy a lot from the free software movement. I inherit a lot of what they are talking about on the show.
Well, none of us is really in a vacuum here, and so much. I mean, and part of it is, though, I think we have to remind ourselves that computers undergird like most aspects of society now, whether it's medicine and your medical records and how these things are shared, to your credit, to your financial life, and as we're going to talk about in a moment or two, our voting lives, our lives as actual, acting citizens within our Republican democracy here in the United States. There's a computer somewhere behind all of it, and how these machines are treated, how these machines are manipulated, have great effects all around, and I think we need to know more. And so a lot of it is that maybe there's this information in the free software movement, but it needs to be liberated and recontextualized, I think, so folks who are not interested in computers in and of themselves might understand how these things will affect them.
Yeah, and one of the themes, I think, of understanding the role of computers and information sharing of all kinds is to not prejudice your thought by thinking that everything you make is yours and it should be treated like a block of land forever that you can pass on. We all build on the past, like Professor Lawrence Lessig is famous for saying. He's a Stanford law professor. He wrote Free Culture, his most recent book. And he points out time and again, whenever people build stuff on the past, we need the ability to do so legally. So we need the permission to share and modify things. We need the ability to have a growing public domain where copyrighted works will expire, the copyright will expire in a timely way, and then enter the public domain where everybody can build on it. That's very, very critical.
And I think there's no greater example than the Disney Corporation, which is one of the biggest advocates and lobbyists for extending the term of copyright way past an author's death, you know, into just scores of years, which made most of its early fortune on the back of public domain stories like Cinderella, or Snow White, which were public domain stories. They paid no royalties on the rights to use those stories and make millions.
Absolutely right, and even more recent stuff like Treasure Planet. That's based on Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, and that's in the public domain. And these copyright extension bills, they're retroactive. So it's not just a matter of saying, okay, from this point forward, copyright will last an additional 20 years. It applies to works that have already been published. And that puts the lie to people like Disney or organizations like Disney and people like Jack Valenti, who try and argue that extending copyright extends and improves people's desire to publish new works. Mm-hmm. It does just the opposite. What happens when an author hits upon a hit book, like, say, Salinger with Catcher in the Rye? He's made, for the rest of his life, and then some. He doesn't have to write any more. But compare that to Mark Twain, who also wanted a very long copyright, like the Disney Corporation and Jack Valenti does. Well, Mark Twain had a very short term of copyright to live with, and that's why we have so many Mark Twain stories
because
today.
Because if he wanted another paycheck, he had to write some more.
Write some more.
If I wanted a paycheck, I got to go to work next week.
Yeah.
And continue to work some more. Well, we've talked about the free culture ideas and the ideas behind copyright many times before, and it's always a very interesting topic. But you brought up to me a related topic that maybe a lot of people don't realize is related. And this is something which maybe some people have heard about, but it's the move towards electronic voting, which is very relevant in that we're in a presidential election year in 2004, and that the very process of voting and counting the votes and whose votes were counted or not counted was pivotal in the 2000 election, which brought President Bush into power. And so you're actually serving on, is it like a commissioner or a panel, or what is it?
It's a review board. We take a look every month. We discuss and take a look at various voting machines and voting equipment. Where Mark Sheldon heads the group I'm in.
And Mark Sheldon, he's the Champaign County Clerk.
Yeah. And his people are great. They work really hard for this board. It's just phenomenal that he brought all these different people from civic organizations and political parties and businesses all together, and we all hash out this stuff every month. So recently, 2 months ago, we had a big demonstration from Diebold and ES&S, two of the biggest companies in voting equipment. Diebold, your listeners might have heard of already because of all the fracas around their touchscreen equipment.
Which they had troubles with in California, which is now, I guess, decided not to use that equipment, correct?
Yeah, they banned it. Mm-hmm. And every county is under this pressure to adopt electronic voting equipment because of the Help Americans Vote Act, which is scary enough in itself. Did you really need help voting?
But, when was this law passed? Do you know?
I think it was just last year.
Okay.
This was a reaction to the Florida election in 2000, where a bunch of people's votes were essentially lost, and then a bunch more people were kept off the voting rolls in what they call scrubbing the voting lists. So the idea was if we modernize the equipment, these kinds of problems won't happen. Well, that's not really what goes on. When you make your voting system electronic, what happens is you put in a black box in the whole situation. Your vote, instead of going on paper and being countable after the vote, in like a recount or counted by hand or even scanned into a computer and then counted again, your vote can be lost in this black box computer.
Now, is this like some, you know, people have probably who use computers had a disk crash on them and maybe lost files or, you know, even, or maybe, you know, if they're dealing with a doctor or dealing with some other agency, their file has been lost, information has been lost. Is this the same sort of thing you're talking about then?
Yeah. I mean, imagine instead of just losing recipes and some emails from friends, which you might be able to get back again, imagine losing votes. I mean, we have an anonymous voting system. You walk into the polling place, and you don't have to identify yourself to the ballot, or in this case, to the voting machine. You just have to prove you are who you say you are, and they keep track so nobody can vote twice. But there's a one-time opportunity to collect somebody's vote and record it accurately and make sure that the voter can verify what their vote mm-hmm. was. If you miss that one-time window, it's gone.
Now, in the current process, which we use in Champaign County, we use the traditional punch ballots, where right. it's a card and you have the stick and you punch through. It's a fairly transparent process. It's very obvious what happens, and you can, even though you can't really look at the card and see your vote, you can see that you have voted and you hand it off to somebody, and you know, at that point you just trust it's getting counted. But the process up to that point is very transparent. You referred to these new electronic machines as a black box.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you mean that it, you know, and that it's completely opaque? You don't know what goes on inside?
Yeah, typically the rule is with what they call DREs or direct recording equipment, like the Diebold touchscreen that's been in the news. You go through a series of screens which ask you pretty plain questions. Who do you want to vote for in this race and in this race? And then you come to a summary screen which shows you the race and the candidate you've chosen. And you click or press accept or reject. And that's it. There's no paper. It's a black box. How your vote gets counted is completely unknown to you. And it's totally unknowable.
Do we know how that software works?
No.
Now, so is that the other big problem then? In addition to the fact that maybe this your vote goes onto a hard disk, which is magnetic, which is fallible, we don't know how this software works.
Right, and it's not software that you can inspect and share and modify. It's proprietary software. It's secret. Now, software has leaked out in some instances. So some people have spent some time reverse engineering things, but that's a very time-consuming process.
And that was not done necessarily by the letter of the law.
Right. And the states have to regulate the software. It has to pass through their hands before it gets on our voting machines, at least ostensibly. One of the charges against Diebold that's quite accurate is that Diebold's engineers and poll workers were able to load software on Diebold machines that had not gone through the state.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it does go through the state, the testing they perform is not that deep because they don't have the source code. Diebold runs Microsoft Windows, a variant of Windows, and then their software is loaded on top of that, just like probably a lot of your listeners have at home.
But a lot of listeners of Windows are also probably also used to constant security alerts.
Yeah.
And all the and worms and viruses, what they have to guard against.
Sure. And there's no way with some of the machines that we saw that you can prevent that. We don't have the source code to Microsoft Windows. We can't tighten certain things. If Microsoft introduces a hole into this particular variant of Windows, then it's going to get copied into your Diebold election machine. Now, by contrast, think about the ESNS machine, Election Systems and Software. I think that's what ESNS stands for. They're one of the other big voting machine manufacturers. They make a device, a pair of devices, actually, that takes a legal size form or a little bit longer, and it's marked so a computer can scan it. You can feed in a blank ballot form and then use the touch screen to register your vote and get the paper out and then verify it by holding it up. And it, when your county buys these machines, the software could, theoretically, although I don't know of anybody who's done it yet, it could be licensed for you to share and modify.
Now you say it could be licensed.
Mm-hmm.
This means that the county could own the rights to look at the actual code that some computer programmer wrote.
Right. The code was written by ESNS. They mm-hmm. told our group that they wrote the operating system, they wrote the voting software, it's all copyrighted to them. And so, therefore, if they hold the copyright, they could license it to a county like Champaign County under terms of a free software license. So we could look at it, we can modify it, we can recompile it, we can share it with other people and say, well, what do you think of this code? And other people will try and contribute patches, and we can review those patches. And there's a very transparent process throughout the whole thing. Everything is in the clear. You can see the code. There's no secrets. So in addition to that, you got a paper trail. So it's good to have both. The software isn't going to make you feel more secure, per se.
Because you're not a computer programmer, for one.
Right. I mean, and how many people are going to be able to walk up to a voting machine and then put aside their voting and start hacking on
them? Well, they shouldn't be able to, right? Isn't that part of the security issue?
Right. So the software is not going to make you feel more secure. The software is going to make it possible for us to keep up with changes. Like if we go to a ranked voting system later on
mm-hmm.
and have some kind of instant runoff or some other kind of counting, then we need to change the software from the winner-take-all, first-past-the-post counting scheme that's already programmed in there. That's very important. And we shouldn't have to go back to the proprietor to say, please do this for us. Because they could turn around and say no, or they could say, sure, but we'll charge you $10,000 per machine, and we just don't have that kind of money.
Now, by comparison, if I look at the Diebold system, which is the other major system, you said it runs on Microsoft Windows.
Yeah.
So even if Diebold were to license the code, the program they'd written,
mm-hmm.
to a county, the county still can't sort of get at everything because they cannot get at the Windows source code.
That's exactly right.
Because it's owned by Microsoft and not by Diebold.
Right.
And I recall part of the problem with the fracas with the Diebold software is that the folks who got a hold of the source code, maybe not through totally legal means, but released it and examined it, found out that it was full of security holes.
Yeah.
And it was very easy for someone to install on a machine that didn't meet spec, mm-hmm. and therefore it could be open to anyone to change, modify, or whatever, if they just plugged in a keyboard and mouse and went to it.
Well, yeah. When you give hardware access to a computer, you're pretty much opening the gates
mm-hmm.
and hoping that people won't mess with your system in a way you don't want them to. So it's very important that the software running on that machine be inspected and checked over thoroughly. And if you can't trust the underlying operating system, then you don't know how that operating system is going to behave, no matter what software you run on top of it.
Now, well, in the Diebold case as well, they tried initially to sue to get that source code closed out and to get it out of public hands.
Yeah.
And keep it from being distributed. They didn't want people to be able to examine it and look at it from the inside, but it's indeed that whole course of action which caused the state of California to say, we will not use these machines.
Yeah, and memos described from Diebold workers saying, revealing things like, oh, they'll never find this out. And
how bad it is.
Yeah, and all sorts of certification procedures they had skirted. There were all these memos going around. And so we're sure that Diebold's system is not completely trustworthy.
So you've seen this ES&S system, right, and you've had a chance to try it out,
mm-hmm.
And you find it to be, at least in your opinion, more satisfactory, more secure than the one which Diebold shows off.
Yeah, by all means. For one thing, you get a paper trail, and the Diebold machine, we are told, could have a voter verified paper ballot. That's the magical term. We were told that they could add that, but they didn't demonstrate it to us, and I'm not one to look at the demo.
So you've tried the machine?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you tried a Diebold machine.
Yeah.
And so you did like a simulation of voting.
Yeah.
And was this like a demo machine, or was this a machine that's currently in use somewhere else?
It's currently in use in Indiana, in Tippecanoe County.
Yeah.
And I took a trip out there with a bunch of other committee members, and we went through sample ballots, and I voted. And at no point was I able to see my vote except for on the screen. I went through the confirmation screen, and it basically, at the end, said, okay, thank you for voting. I had nothing to walk away with. So that machine counted and ostensibly recorded the votes, and at the end of the day, the poll worker could press a button and generate a log of what I'm supposed to assume are votes, but who knows what
they
really
are. Did you get to see the log of
that
demo?
Oh, no. I mean, I got to saw the log of the demo, but if I were a voter, I wouldn't get to see it.
So you saw the log, and was your vote there?
I don't know, because there were so many other votes, and they were printed in a random order. It was hard for me to figure out where I was.
Whereas with this other machine with ES&S, it gives you this paper ballot, which you then feed into another machine,
I think
you're telling me, so that's where it gets counted.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a two-step process, or even the machine where you do the actual vote, it gets printed in a machine-readable form,
mm-hmm.
and then you gets counted in a whole other machine, so you can make sure it's good before you feed it in.
Exactly. And you don't have to trust these the first machine if you don't want to. You can be given this form in a folder, like a cardboard sleeve, and then take a number two pencil in there and mark it up, and then feed it into the second, the counting machine. And the paper is stored in a locked box after it's counted. So even if the computer count isn't to your liking, if you don't trust it, we can just get people in rooms to sit there and manually count things.
Kind of like in Florida.
Yeah.
Stop the counting.
Right.
Well, real quick, before we get only just about a moment or so to go, how did you get onto this commission?
Through the Prairie Greens. I'm a member of the Prairie Greens.
I see.
And the Mark Sheldon's office went to a bunch of political organizations and said, would you like to send a representative?
Okay. Okay, so trying to get all the various parties in on this,
yeah,
and to be able to take a look at this. And will there be? Are you going to generate a report? Is there, before this is chosen, is it up to Mark Sheldon to choose this machine, or is it city council sort of county board kind of thing?
Yeah, we're a recommendation board. The real power rests with the county board.
Okay,
we make our recommendation to them. They sign the papers, pay the people.
Well, as things get closer to the election time, I'll definitely want to have you back, and I really want to encourage people to listen to your program. I guess the next one is a month from Wednesday.
Yeah.
What's the date on that? Do you know?
Oh, I don't.
He pulls up his calendar. That's Digital Citizen, alternating Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Jeff's going to take a much-deserved vacation, but he'll be back.
The 28th.
On the 28th of July, where you can learn more about these issues. He keeps us up to date constantly. It's a really valuable program and utterly unique in the whole world of radio that I'm aware of, and we're very lucky to have him here at WEFT. Once again, Jeff, thanks a lot. I learn something every time you come on, and I'm walking away a little better informed.
Well, thanks for having me, Paul.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.